What's your name and what do you do?
My name is Mary Kulbrenner, and I'm a doctor, but I'm an inner city family practice doctor who works at a federally funded community health center in Washington, D.C. And I always feel when people ask me what I do, that the doctor part isn't really as important as the where I doctor part.
What is the very first thing you do when you get to work each morning?
Well, the first thing I do, actually, is I see how hot it is, because this is a really, really old building. And it's a building that Unity Healthcare doesn't rent from the Department of Health, but they give it to us. And so nobody wants to put a lot of money into the building. So there are times during the winter when you walk into the building and it's like 90 degrees. We've had to close three times this year. And so the first thing I do, honestly, is I walk in. I try to figure out if I'm warm because I just came from outside or if I'm warm because it's already 95 degrees. And if there are all these patients in the lobby part, I know it's because it's really hot and the waiting room is like not a healthy place to be. So that's the first thing I do. Then I walk past, I go into my office, I walk through the waiting room to my office, which is always sort of an obstacle course of sorts. I've been working with the same people, many of them, for 10 or 11 years. And they feel like they own a part of me, right? So when I walk into the waiting room, like, Dr. Kulbrenner, you got to talk to me about my leg. And so every morning I walk in and I smile and I say, I'm happy to see you when you come back into my offices. And then I go into the group of offices. So the way it works in my office, and again, this is by default. It wasn't like someone said, what's the best way for doctors to work together? It's just a site that doesn't have a lot of options. So all the doctors are together in a big room. We all have our computers. So I go in, I sit down, I log on to my computer, I see if I have any patients waiting for me, and then my day begins. Usually my day begins when my medical assistant, who is marvelous and incredibly smart and funny, comes back and says, Dr. Kulbrenner, I got two ready for you. And then I go to the two exam rooms that I use. And often during the day, I won't get back to my office for hours because I'm just going exam. Many doctors, the day before their patients come in, look to see who's on their list. So they know who to expect. And they also prepare for that person, right? I think there are medically very good reasons to do that. And yet I have never done it. Because I like the moment of walking into a room and being surprised by who's in front of me. I find that, whatever, 18 times a day gives me a kind of pleasure. So Monday mornings tends to be when I do my narcotics. So I have dedicated slots for patients who need monthly pain medication. According to the law in DC and Medicaid law, I have to write prescriptions for people every month. So on Monday morning, I know usually my first three patients are going to be amongst the 20 or 30 patients I see monthly to give narcotics for chronic pain to. One might be a 60-year-old woman with really bad arthritis in her knees who just takes a Percocet every once in a while in order to get through. Someone else might be someone who is a heroin addict who's finally clean but has back pain. And there's a lot of issues with pain threshold in old opiate addicts. And so that's somebody who I might give stronger medicine to, although, you know, the politics of this are really, really complicated. Now, I have patients who I've been seeing for 10 years. I've been giving them narcotics once a month for 10 years. And before I saw them, 10 years before that, they were heroin addicts. But they have genuine pathology, which means they have things that are wrong with them that cause them pain. Managing pain now has become one of the things that's most difficult for me because we know we don't do it well. And we know even when we do it well, we create addicts. Everybody always wants a higher dose. Nobody has pain control. And when I was younger, and the literature on pain was younger, I mean, I sort of grew up in the whole world of pain medicine. There was a moment medically where there was the belief that you treat pain and the pain is better. And that's why we do it. And that's humane. And that's still true very much, I guess, for cancer patients or terminal patients. But now I would say the literature says we treat pain. Patients are going to continue to be in pain. You're going to use higher amounts of medicine, but it's not going to lower their pain, that you're going to end up in this spiral. And so I do that on Monday mornings. And that there's always a sadness in that.
So if a patient who you're giving regular narcotics to says, you know what, I want a higher dose. I need a higher dose. Dr. Kulbrenner, I need a higher dose. What's your response?
I tend to believe anything everybody tells me. So I don't like to be skeptical. I just don't. Now, that said, I drug test my patients who are getting narcotics. And that took me years to be able to do without feeling guilty about it. I felt less guilty when lots of them came back with lots of things that weren't supposed to be in their bodies, right? In other words, you're testing the guy you're giving Percocet to and they come back positive for cocaine and PCP. And that has happened more often than I'd like. And then I end up in this crazy situation with patients where I become the sort of general as opposed to the doctor. You know, I had a patient for a long time who was an HIV patient. I bartered pain medicines for her taking her HIV meds. I don't know how else to say it. Did she have real back pain? Sure. And she was a history of a crack addict, and she knew she had to be clean, that I was going to test her every month, that she had to be clean. But I made the choice. I said to her, if you come every month for your narcotics, and when you come every month, I can tell that you are seeing our on-site HIV specialist and getting your blood work, and your blood work shows you're taking your medication, you're not going to get any problem from me. That's the deal, right? That's the deal. And for 2 years, it worked. And a patient who had never taken her HIV meds regularly, we got her HIV numbers down. And I felt like sort of smug, like I had done this arrogant thing and not totally followed the rules. And then she came back positive for cocaine. Then I had to cut her off. And then I never saw her again in the clinic.
So you do end up cutting people off. That does happen.
I would say every 3 or 4 months, there's somebody who I have to say, this is not something I can do. The most peculiar thing that I sometimes do is I'll have a patient. I have this awesome guy who I saw maybe for 3 or 4 years. He was desperate to work. And I said to him when he first came in, all right, we're going to medicate you so you can work. We're going to medicate you so you can work. That's going to be our goal because you don't trust the back surgery and you've tried the physical therapy and you've had the epidural injections and this is the end of the road. I really, really respected this guy and really was rooting for him hard. He was a construction worker and he worked for about a year or two and became manager of the site and was doing great. And I was giving him his meds. And then I got a letter from the insurance company saying, these are the different people giving this patient narcotics. And you're like, oh, not this dude, not this dude, not this dude, right? So I go in the next time he comes and I say, sir, what? And he looked at me very clearly and he said, Dr. Kohlbrenner, I'm an addict. I needed the pills to work and now I need more pills because I'm an addict. And I looked at him and I said, you know, that this conversation means that I can no longer be your drug dealer. This is done. It's over. Like, this is it. And he started to cry because of so many different losses for him, right? It wasn't just that I was cutting him off. And he said, I need to work. There's no good rehab options for me with my insurance. And what I'm going to end up doing is buying on the street. And I thought, like, watch the system fail.
Are all of your patients coming to you on Medicaid?
I have some Medicare patients. I have primarily Medicaid patients. And the other phenomenon that's starting to happen, which is really recent, is the neighborhood that I work in, which is in Southeast, is proximate to some nice capital city neighborhoods. And people come to D.C. for their federal job. And D.C. is a disastrous place to find medical care that accepts insurance. Internal medicine, family practice doctors are really hard to find. So they open their book. They see my name and they come to see me and they walk in their suit and tie and they come into the waiting room and they're like, whoa, this isn't Kansas, right? Because the waiting room is, I don't know, 50 folding chairs in a, you know, uncarpeted room with like 2 TV sets on the wall. It's not a high-end waiting room. And so I've had a couple of these patients, many more lately, because I think what's happening is Capitol Hill's getting nicer and nicer. And they come back, I have to say. I see them and they come back and they see me again.
You have the narcotics patients, but that isn't obviously not the majority of your practice. So what's another category or set of things that you tend to deal with a lot or particularly fun to deal with?
Part of the reason I became a family practice doctor is because of the variation. I wouldn't want to just see pediatrics, but having a day punctuated by pediatrics is awesome, right? Because kids are usually well in big ways, right? I mean, they have little ups and downs. So they're not as intellectually challenging unless they're very sick, and very sick kids tend to go to specialists. So my adult patients are much more intellectually challenging for me, but my pediatric patients are challenging in other ways. So because I've been practicing in the community for 11 years now, my kids have grown up. I'm taking care of babies of kids I took care of as teenagers. On one hand, I can be snarky sometimes and be like, well, you know, I met her when she was 10 and now she's 15, so I'm taking care of her baby, which happens. But, you know, sometimes that 15-year-old turns out to be a lovely mom. You get to watch her find who she is. I don't know. I don't mean to sound Pollyanna. I'm not Pollyanna. Like, I see a lot of bad things. I see a lot of kids who are not getting what I believe kids should get, right? They're certainly not getting what my children get from me. So two kids, both boys I started seeing when they were five, both African-American boys and single mom families with multiple brothers and sisters, and both are now in prison or in halfway house now. And both moms, when I recently saw them, had a kind of passivity that was new. One of the moms is very, very, very outspoken, and she's always like, Dr. Kohlbrenner, you don't, you're a Washington, D.C., Northwest white girl. You don't know anything. And I always say, you know, yeah, you're right. I don't know anything about what your reality is, but I do know what you're doing right now might not be working, right? Like, so she and I have a very, very sort of open relationship in that she feels completely comfortable telling me she thinks I'm an idiot a lot of the time. What she said to me was, Dr. Kohlbrenner, there is nothing I can do for that boy anymore. The idea of being done with your kid when they're 15, when you're a good mom, I mean, where you take, she takes care of her kids. She works, her kids eat dinner together. She's doing her best. And I don't know where to put it. And I said to her, I said, you know, with all due respect, I really try to be respectful. I said, if you don't have faith in him, what does he have left? And she said, I heard that, Dr. Kohlbrenner, I heard that. And I thought, that's like the best I'm going to do. And I'm not judging these women. They just don't know what to do. They haven't given up in like an existential way. They've given up in a practical way. They have no options. And that feeling of helplessness is so palpable that what can they do?
The Working Podcast is brought to you by Delta Airlines, whose new Delta Studio provides more streaming entertainment in the sky. Additionally, Delta's long-haul fleet not only has more flatbed seats, but more flatbed seats available with direct aisle access. Learn more at delta.com. Delta, keep climbing. And now back to my interview.
A lot of my patients, the adult patients, one-third of them probably are, you know, obese, diabetic, with hypertension, type 2 diabetes from the weight. Depending where someone is, if someone's in the beginning of this journey into chronic illness, and I've had some patients recently who are on the beginning, so they're like 50 years old, their blood sugar's up, their blood pressure's up, they come to see me. Sometimes you can say to people, never see me again, but exercise 5 days a week and eat fruits and vegetables, and you will be better off than if you come to my office. And sometimes that works, right? I mean, they keep coming to my office, but the idea is, what I have to offer is not half as important as what you have to offer. So when I first started working, they were like, we're going to figure out the body mass index on people and we're going to discuss it with them and we're going to change the obesity epidemic. It's just about acknowledging it. And I remember thinking always that this is just total crap, right? And it's still true for my peds kids, for my kids who are overweight. I'm supposed to get their cholesterol and get their blood sugar. And I'm like, but why? We don't treat at that age. And it doesn't do anything to help anybody. So I can't remember who wrote this, but it was really compelling to me. The reason poor people eat so poorly is because it tastes good. Now, that sounds really like dumb, but it's totally true. I'm not even talking about the cost of produce. Let's not even do that. Let's say you have a choice of going home and making yourself rice and beans and some broccoli, or going to McDonald's, costing the exact same amount. Your life is stressful. You don't have enough money. Your housing situation might not be stable. Your kid stayed out all night the night before. Your kid who's going to college, you don't know how you're going to pay for it, if you're going to make it through the 4 years. At that moment, you want a little pleasure. And so what I've learned over the years is that the medical voice of power and this is what's right for you and is just so unhelpful because the patients, they know they're just looking for some pleasure. They don't have access to the same pleasures that I have in terms of even coming home to a full refrigerator and making a delicious meal for my family, because my delicious meal for my family costs $30 for one meal, right? And so the longer I'm at this, the longer I struggle with my own role as the advisor because of the opportunity gap. And what I think about it is an opportunity for pleasure.
What are health problems that the poor have that others don't?
I'm not an expert on this because I only work with the poor. And so I think what we see with the poor, certainly because there's more obesity, I think, we see more chronic illness of the kind of diabetes, hypertension, kidney disease. We see tons of really severe arthritis because if you're walking 300 pounds or walking on those knees are going to have a hard time. You know, I see a lot more sexual and physical abuse and a lot more loss. You know, there was a period of time when I was asking every patient if they had lost anyone to violence. And 4 out of 6 patients said yes. Again, what do I see? I see these opportunity gaps, which make it harder to live healthfully. The chronically poor and disabled, so patients with arthritis bad enough that they're disabled, they become extremely isolated. I see a kind of isolation I hope doesn't exist anywhere else. I don't know. You know, many patients wake up in the morning, they turn on their television. At the end of the day, they turn it off and they go to bed, right? I mean, I had one patient who told me she watched Law and Order like 9 times a day because she could go from one, you know, UPN channel to another UPN channel. I mean, it's much harder to have hope in poverty. It's hard for me to answer that question. I mean, I certainly definitely have more 15-year-old kids who come in pregnant, right, who I'm helping navigate that. I just had someone come in the other day, and she was a cute little 24-year-old woman who already had 2 children who were like 6 and 3. 2 weeks before, she had come in for a kind of birth control, which you insert in your arm. And you can't put it in unless you're sure the patient isn't pregnant. So I said to her, listen, have you had unprotected sex in the last 2 weeks? And she said, I have. And I said, listen, come back in 2 weeks. We'll get another negative pregnancy test and I'll put it in. And she came back and it was positive. And she works. She's a manager at a fast food restaurant and she's proud of her life. Like, she's a single mom, but she takes care of her kids. And she just wept. She has children. She knows what an abortion means. It's painful to her. But she knows if she has another one, she's not going to be able to stay manager of that restaurant. And the other thing is she needs $350 because Medicaid doesn't pay for abortions because we're in the District of Columbia and the Congress won't permit it to. And $350 is a lot of money. It is enough money that she might not get it because she doesn't have the money. That she, in her mind, you're watching her scramble in her mind, how do I do this? So she's ashamed. And she needs to ask for help. And Jesus Christ, she had unprotected sex even though she has 2 children and knows how it works. That's sort of the feeling I have a lot, which is, I feel so much compassion for you. What were you thinking? I say, what were you thinking? I do not feel that my being inauthentic helps anybody. And I feel that my patients know that I feel every time I walk into a room, it is a privilege for me to talk to them. And that I can say something judgmental without being judgmental, right? I can say, like, this, you need to take hold of this or that. Or, you know, this other patient I was telling you about from earlier, she and I had a conversation about hitting your kids. This was last week. And she was saying, Dr. Kohlbrenner, sometimes you have to whoop your kids. Sometimes you have to whoop your kids because you're so angry at them, there's nothing else you can do. And I looked at her and I was like, I never hit my kids. And she looked at me and she was like, you again, Dr. Kohlbrenner, white woman, Northwest Washington, you don't know what problems are. Okay, that's right. So then I go to my next tactic. Does it help? She's really smart. She says, I feel better afterwards. I say, but does it stop whatever behavior they're doing that you don't want? Nah. I mean, it's just, there are so many cultural differences, right? So that nah, she didn't have like an epiphany and say, Dr. Kohlbrenner is right. I'm going to stop hitting my children because it is not effective parenting. She was just like, I do it because I'm angry.
So a lot of what you're talking about is it sounds as though your practice is psychotherapy. Is that just because you're picking out examples like that? Or is it, are most of the patients, are you treating them as a psychologist might at the same time you're treating whatever medical problems you're treating?
You know, maybe this is, I don't think this is about poverty. I think this is about human connection, that you can't treat anybody for anything without connecting to them. I couldn't possibly sustain a day of 18 patients like the ones I've talked to you about, right? It would be unsustainable. I couldn't psychologically do it or physically find the time to do it. But I do believe in connection. So if I walk in and there's a two-year-old on the table, I walk up to the two-year-old and I say, hello, what are you here for today? So what I would say is that all healthcare should begin with connection. Even if I'm doing a strep test or treating your high blood pressure, I don't want, there's some number like more than 50% of patients on medicines are non-compliant. So walking in and being like, well, you have high blood pressure and you need the Norvasc. I mean, I do that, right? I hear myself say it 100 times a day. We're going to put you on medication for your high blood pressure, and high blood pressure is a silent killer, and I know you feel fine. It increases your risk for stroke, blah, blah, blah. But I try not to be the person in the Peanuts cartoon going, blah, 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 blah. I try to say something that shows I've connected to the person. You know, medicine has become really algorithmic in a way that I think most people don't realize. If you're doing good medicine today, you are following algorithms. Most doctors don't want to say that because it makes them feel like, why the fuck did I go to school for so long to follow an algorithm? But, you know, if I'm treating hypertension now, I'm supposed to use a certain kind of medicine first. And if that's not enough, I'm supposed to add another kind of medicine. And there's some choice within this, but the choice doesn't matter. So if you are self-important enough to believe that that choice matters, maybe that's enough to get you through the day. But I'm really an evidence, I mean, I guess the part of myself I haven't shared with you at all is the evidence-based doctor in me. I read all the literature. I don't believe in my intuition more than I believe in the algorithm. I had a really interesting thing happen the other day, which belies this whole thing sort of, which is a 23-year-old kid who I've known since he was 12 came in, and he's a kid who came out to me. I saw him, and when he was like 13, it was clear his, you know, eyebrows were waxed and he was, you know, all groomed. I would say, do you have sex with men or women or both? Are you interested? And he was always really closed about it. And then he turned about 17 or 18, and I think he came out to his family, and he, like, came out to me. It was sort of one of the sweetest moments of my career. Dr. Kohlbrenner, I've been thinking a lot about this. I really want to tell you that I'm gay. Anyway, I hadn't seen him in a couple of years, and he came back, and he came in, and he had this weird constellation of symptoms. And he had been to the ER with kidney stones, and his CAT scan showed inflamed lymph nodes in his abdomen. And he'd lost some weight. And I'm like, what is going on with this kid? I'm going to have to do a really full evaluation and do all the blood work. And I do all the blood work, including an HIV test. But I swear, because I've been seeing this kid for 10 years and I've talked to him about condoms 900 times, it doesn't occur to me that he has HIV, even though the medical story that I painted is an HIV picture. It's new onset HIV. And I didn't make any medical mistakes, right? I checked him. And I felt really glad to be able to tell this kid so he could cry and come back and see me. And I could set him up with our HIV clinic is superb. And I could set him up with people who I knew would be really humane with him. But I guess what I was trying to say is this sort of the personal and the medical and how they interrelate get complicated. It's not always straightforward, right? I didn't do him a disservice. And I probably did more for him, in fact, because I was listening so hard, because I've known him for so long. But it just shocked me that I didn't come to the obvious conclusion because I didn't want to.
So you're in your 40s, barely. You're in your 40s. Do you see yourself doing this job to retirement? Is this something you can do? You've done it for most of your medical career.
All
of your medical career. Do you see yourself doing this until you're, you know, 70?
I think so. You know, we have three children and talks of private school, and I say to myself, really, Mary, it's time to actually earn some money. You just have to stop making decisions the way you've been making them. And then I play it out in my mind, and I feel really sad. I don't want to do it. These are questions of identity, I think, in some ways. Like, maybe I just like being the person who helps the poor. Maybe it's that narcissistic. Maybe there's an authenticity in my dealings with my patients because we come from such different cultures that we don't get lost in the trappings at all. There's a real connection. I know that sounds counterintuitive, but sometimes difference makes connection more honest. And there's also something really awesome about waking up in the morning and doing something you know it's really hard for them to find doctors to do. If I leave, the likelihood they're going to be I'm going to be replaced by someone with equal experience is zero. They might get some really smart kid straight out of residency who's going to work 3 years because our site is a they get loan repayment. But most of them aren't going to stay more than those 3 years. Right? Like, I am the old lady at the clinic, but I don't feel that like I'm the old lady and worthless. I feel like I've worked 3 days a week for many, many, many years, and I keep thinking that there's more that I need to do, whether write or get involved in policy. But then it becomes a different question about parenting and marriage and division of labor and just time constraints. So I would say if I had no time constraints, I would do this forever, and I would do something else also. But because I have the time constraints at this point in my life, I will probably just do this forever.